Michael Hopwood is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Melbourne and joins us on the program. Good morning, Michael. Malcolm.
Good morning, Chair.
Malcolm, can we start out by taking a look at the work that you've done in a study on veterans and the types of problems that you've seen?
Yeah, look, I think we now have a lot of evidence that demonstrates that one of the inevitable consequences of sending people to war is going to be the development of new mental health disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, sadly increased rates of substance abuse. And it doesn't really seem to matter what the nature of the conflict is, inevitably some of this is going to occur. It's often assumed that post-traumatic stress disorder is the mental health problem that occurs after conflict, but in fact it's only one of a range of disorders that occur. We see rates of these that indicate that they really are a major public health problem. And one of the considerations that we should put in place when we're sending people away to war is accepting that this is going to happen.
Does that mean that if we send people away to war, there's going to be some type of effect, and that every single veteran that comes back should receive some type of treatment or some type of counselling because there will be some type of effect on that spectrum?
Well, it's interesting that you might almost imagine that why wouldn't everyone be affected, but in fact they're not. So the best data we have is probably from studies of people who went to Vietnam that suggest following experience of combat during Vietnam, about one in four or one in five of the veterans who went developed post-traumatic stress disorder, and probably about half of those, so one in eight or thereabouts, developed a very long-term problem. So not everyone does, thankfully, but clearly everyone's at risk. There's long been a view held that perhaps we can minimise these problems by delivering debriefing or some such intervention as soon as people are relieved from their immediate combat situation. Whilst that sounds like a good idea, doesn't it?
Mm.
Unfortunately, the evidence that that necessarily prevents the development of PTSD is still argued and actually not very strong. What's probably just as important is picking up early on those people who do develop symptoms and then providing intervention.
Malcolm, what about prevention before? Is there any way of being able to prepare people better for what they're likely to be coming across in conflict? Or do you not want to do that because you're going to put the fear of God in them?
Yeah, well, clearly prevention would ultimately be the holy grail. However, like the Holy Grail, it's probably a little bit more mythical than real. So the nature of combat is such that it's pretty difficult to imagine you can inoculate people completely to the point where it won't be traumatic. We do know there are some risk factors for the development of disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder. So a prior history of disorders like depression or anxiety is somewhat of a risk factor. We do know that a prior history of personal trauma, say for example in childhood, is somewhat of a risk factor, although they're not absolute risk factors. Now, are they sufficient that you could screen out for those things and prevent people going to combat who have those difficulties? Well, that's a lot more complicated than it sounds. So, for example, what sort of childhood trauma would you screen people out for? Can you guarantee that just because they've had childhood trauma, they absolutely certainly will develop post-traumatic stress disorder? No, you can't. And will they, of course, tell you anyway? They may not. So, in practice, screening and prevention is quite difficult.
Do you have to be very careful going down that line as well? Because one of the things that can happen for veterans when they return and they're being diagnosed for post-traumatic stress disorder is that you need to be getting some support from Veteran Affairs, and there can be the argument put forward that, oh, yes, but it wasn't the trauma that occurred to you while you're in the war. It was something that happened to you earlier in life.
Yeah, look, that's quite right. And we can end up in some very complex and at times quite bitter arguments. You're absolutely right. I think, to my own mind, one of the critical elements in determining those kind of situations is exactly what the trajectory of the person's life was before they were subject to that trauma, in this case war, and what was it like afterwards. So no matter what's happened in your life, if you were seeming to go pretty well and then something happened, like you went to war, and your life after that was considerably altered and you were disabled, that's what counts.
Malcolm, it's called post-traumatic stress disorder, so it's after the event. Are there a lot of cases by which it is just traumatic stress, by which it happens when you're in combat? Or is there some sort of a numbness that happens when you're in combat and the effects kick in later?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting question. Of course, for most people who develop post-traumatic stress disorder, the onset of the symptoms actually is fairly soon after their traumatic experience. So we often hear discussion of so-called delayed onset post-traumatic stress disorder, where symptoms first occur months or years after the trauma. Probably what's much more common is that the person has those symptoms from very soon after the trauma, but just doesn't tell anyone. So there's an immediate fear: if I start going to see, for example, a health professional, and I talk about this experience, that will actually cause me distress, and therefore there's an avoidance of actually seeking help, which is indeed one of the core parts of the disorder. So many of the people who do ultimately develop PTSD actually report feeling troubled from within days of the event.
Malcolm, when you take a look at the effects of these disorders, it's not only the effects that it has on the veteran themselves, but there are wider social problems associated with family as well, because the effects that it has on them and then has a chain reaction through to family.
Yeah, look, that's very true. So the nature of disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder, I beg your pardon, and depression, is that they fundamentally interfere with an individual's ability to feel close and interact effectively with those around them, even if they desperately want to. So part of post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, is what we call numbing of emotions. And people with post-traumatic stress disorder will often describe this inability to get close to and interact effectively with the people they love. So they desperately love them, can't get close, and then associated with their arousal is often high levels of irritability, which pushes people further away. So you're quite right. The ramifications of this can be felt right throughout the whole family and indeed the sort of whole social network that person might have had before they went to conflict.
Because if then as a parent, if you then find it hard to get close to your siblings and that affects relationship, then that affects their relationships with other people down the line as well.
Yeah, correct. And we do see this sense of an intergenerational problem that can be created as a result of something like post-traumatic stress disorder. Absolutely.
Fiona, good morning.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning, Malcolm. I'm sitting here listening to all of this as a daughter of a Kokoda, Salamoa and Solomon's veteran who was in the field ambulance. They were trained both for combat as well as picking up the pieces of the wounded and the dead.
Yep.
I grew up with my dad screaming in the bedroom next to me. Some of my friends thought our house was haunted when they stayed from his screams. A couple of times he tried to strangle my mum in his sleep because he thought she was a Japanese coming to get him. He had a really major breakdown very soon after the war and did about 3 or 4 months in at Fairfield, where they did really meaningful things like weaving scarves. Then for years he went untreated. And he went in to have a hernia operation, and when he was about to go off for his anaesthetic, his GP, who was wonderful, heard him reeling off everything he had to do to give an anaesthetic and going through, you know, like 7 drops of such and such. Yep. And they used to use gas when he was doing anaesthetics and things. And, and around this time of the year, it was always hell. My mum used to try and send him off with my uncle to go up the Murray, or she would come and stay with me. Because, like, all of the programs that were coming up on telly were making it worse. Finally, he was under the treatment of some wonderful psychiatrists, and he began writing about his experiences, and I think that made a huge difference.
How much later was that, Fiona?
Oh, he was 80 when he had his first story published.
Jeez.
He's now 95. He's in a nursing home here in town, and he was never, ever violent. He was just the most wonderful man. But as I said, the dreams and the, at times he would just pour his heart out sometimes when he and I would be driving in the car. He witnessed a group of quite close friends. He waved them over for a cup of tea and they hit a mine and it blew up the whole truck and they were all killed, not to mention the number of people that they were, just losing from stomach wounds, from malaria, all of those things. And when my mum was in her sort of last stages of life, when she was in agonising pain, it became too much for my dad to nurse her because it was just bringing up too many memories.
Fiona, I want to go back to Malcolm. It's a great story that you tell. And Malcolm, you realise, especially with veterans from World War II, of which my dad was a World War II vet, didn't have the same issues as Fiona's dad did. However, there were some. World War II, we're in a process by which men are told that you stick it through, that you're tough, that you don't need to talk to people, and that really the only people they spoke to were their fellow veterans.
Yes, look, I think there's little doubt that we handled these problems very differently as a society. After World War II and other conflicts like Korea, for that matter, too. All the evidence we have suggests these problems were just as common amongst people who went to World War II. What tended to happen, I guess, were a few things. First of all, because, particularly with World War II, the proportion of the male population of the right age who went to conflict was so high that society, in a sense, almost adapted around the fact that many of them were affected. And it was kind of, oh, yes, he went to the war, that explains the way he is, but it was not taken on as a problem to actually confront and treat and deal with.
So it was almost that society enveloped themselves around them instead of them having to fit back into society.
Yeah, look, I think in some ways that's right. Whereas after some of the more recent conflicts, as a proportion of the population, people who went to the conflict are much smaller. I think nowadays, some of the people after World War II, there were also employment opportunities where they could find, if you like, a niche where that would help, in a way, stabilise things somewhat. Nowadays, those kind of jobs are much harder to find. There's a greater sort of pressure and expectation on performance. So for many of the vets returning from recent conflicts, unemployment and difficulty getting back into the basic roles of society just adds to their disability.
Because there were so many servicemen coming back from the Second World War.
Yeah, correct.
There was almost the society was the support.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. So that did...
And they were heroes. They were considered heroes at that time too.
Correct. Please don't get me wrong, I don't want to suggest that their situation was idyllic. So the treatments that were available then for these disorders, if people sought out treatment, was clearly much less developed than now. So many of them, just as your caller described, lived with these symptoms for many, many years. What I was also fascinated with during that call was how her dad hung on to his memories for many, many years before he actually talked to anyone about what had happened. So previously at the Heidelberg Repat, I was involved in a program with World War II veterans, and it was amazing how many of them did exactly that. They, until they were in their 80s, they basically not told their families what they'd done. Their families would know they'd been to war, they'd been away for a number of years, they might know, for example, they were in the Navy, But any detail more than that, they just didn't know. So when they're in their 80s, they reached a point where they felt, look, if I don't tell someone now, I'm never going to.
Well, I remember watching a program taking a look at post-traumatic stress and recognising whether or not you're from the Second World War, from Vietnam, from Afghanistan, from Korea. There's probably no cure to post-traumatic stress, but there's being able to learn how to live with it and cope with it because you can't get rid of memories.
Well, it is important to separate out two things there.
Mm-hmm.
The memories that are involved with war are probably extremely difficult to ever get rid of. There's no doubt about that. Of course, not everyone who has a memory of war has post-traumatic stress disorder. With post-traumatic stress disorder, if you do have it, it does seem true that if it's persisted beyond, let's say, 3 to 5 years, the chance of it completely going away is decreasing significantly. However, even many years after first developing post-traumatic stress disorder, our contemporary treatments can be of benefit. So it mightn't get rid of the problem, but can be of benefit. And that's still a very useful thing.
David, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Look, I've had the opportunity as an amateur military historian to interview men for the last 30, 40 years, and I've found a lot of the boys that fought in the jungle campaigns, they hated the night. When they were in forward listening posts and they all took a turn, that was horrifying because the Japanese were very, very good at infiltrating lines. And as that former speaker said, that many of the boys I knew, they had terrible nightmares at night times, trying to strangle their wives. Their lives were ruined by taking to the bottle and trying to blot out these terrible memories. And even now I'm interviewing boys in their 90s, and a good mate of mine who's now deceased had fought at the Battle of Kokoda. He told me that even today, David, I can't stand the night, and he said, I can't stand the dark, and I can't stand people coming up behind me. So that tells you a lot.
Mm.
And as the gentleman just said, only now are they trying to unburden themselves. But I've found that working with them, that and they tell their family what's been actually or what actually happened to them, it's actually helped them a lot because they've been unburdened. And I've seen some very emotional times in homes with veterans when they've actually let loose on what really did happen to them, you know, and it's tragedy they've had to carry it. The Australian way was to suck it up and get on with life, and my famous saying is that men that survived the war never survived the war because they live with it for all their lives, and it's a tragedy that nothing was done for these men, and that's what makes them such great Australians, because they wore it, you know, and they shouldn't have had to wear the tragedy of it all.
Yeah, and that's what's difficult. I should point out that both Malcolm and I, I'm sure, are not saying that it was easy for people who came back from the Second World War. It was just a different experience and environment for them socially when they came back. One of the things that comes out of that conversation with David, Malcolm, is the stories and the release. Why is it that there was a feeling for veterans that they didn't want to talk about it? Was it that it was so traumatic they didn't want other people to be traumatised the way that they were?
Look, I think it's a bit of that. So I think, as your caller said, it was quite right. The culture then was very much of a sort of stiff upper lip. Grown men don't cry and therefore, you know, wouldn't necessarily talk about emotional experiences. Indeed, at first talking about these traumatic memories will by nature be emotional. I think they're often actively discouraged from discussing these difficulties, in fact. And yes, you're quite right, as part of the disorder, like post-traumatic stress disorder itself, there is a natural avoidance of both discussion of the memories and avoidance of reminders of the memories. So for many veterans from war, as your first caller described, seeing television or newspaper items about war, and prior to Anzac Day, there's a lot of them, obviously, was an extremely distressing thing, such that they wouldn't be able to look at the television, wouldn't be able to look at the newspaper, wouldn't be able to even talk to other veterans at times.
I mean, we should point out that post-traumatic stress disorder doesn't only exist amongst veterans. It affects police, people in all sorts of emergency services, in all sorts of jobs where they come across traumatic events.
Yeah, that's quite right. So if we look at data from the most recent Australian Survey of Mental Health and Wellbeing, an Australian survey looking at rates of mental health disorder in our community, the 12-month prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder was probably of the order of 3 to 4%. So it's not a rare disorder. Most of the people in the community who had post-traumatic stress disorder weren't veterans. They were affected by car accidents, assaults, or sadly, even things like sexual assault.
Malcolm, we were just heard about veterans talking and sharing their experiences, whether it be from Second World War through to Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam. As a professor of psychiatry and somebody who works within the field, why is it important that people talk about it?
Well, the best evidence we have for any treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder is what's called exposure-based psychotherapy. What we find is that where people talk about their traumatic memories and experience the arousal associated with them, that if they can do that in a repeated fashion, over time, the arousal associated with that memory does tend to diminish. So at one level, it's quite a simple idea. Talking about it does appear to be effective. Now, that might sound simple, but clearly that's not going to be easy for people to do. So often prior to doing that kind of psychotherapeutic work, they're going to need to work on skills to manage that arousal and anxiety. They may well also need treatment for the disorders that often co-occur with post-traumatic stress disorder, like depression, or like, as one of your callers said, problems with hitting the bottle.
Pat joins us. Hello, Pat.
Oh, hi, good morning. I was just listening to the first comments regarding World War II veterans and how, or the theory that society enveloped them because of the numbers when they came back. My dad was a Spitfire pilot who was one of the first Australian squadrons to go over to England, and he was one of only two of that group to come back. And he never recovered, and stories we've heard about screaming and trying to strangle my mum and just reliving it all the time, unable to talk about it because maybe, you know, a couple would have come back in the group but weren't pilots and seen what he had seen, were able to get on with their lives. It was seen as a weakness to not get on with your life. And he suffered till his very final cancer-ridden days. He's been gone now 15 years. He was older than a lot of them, so he saw all his friends die and then younger and younger 18-year-olds come through, and he'd be writing letters to their parents and getting letters from their parents. And he had them in his drawer. We found them after he had passed. And that was really upsetting for us, and it explained a lot. And I don't think it's really understood how much they suffered, you know, and kept it to themselves.
And in silence, Pat.
In silence, just suffered in silence. He got on with his life because he had to, and he had a family, and that's all he wanted was his family.
It showed a great deal of strength for those men to be able to achieve that in a lot of ways, wasn't there, Pat?
Oh, look, I didn't appreciate my dad and till his latter years when I understood. One night would be the Battle of Britain night. He and his friend, who had been in New Guinea and seen many of his friends' heads chopped, were told never to look back, just run. But he looked back. If they crashed, don't look back, just run. But he did look back and see heads chopped. And so that was the one night my dad would have a drink with his friend who was an alcoholic, and I would wait up till they got home, which would be about 4 in the morning, and I was still at school in those days, and make sure they were all right and get them coffees and just, they never let me hear what they were talking about. But that was the only time I'd ever see tears.
Pat, thank you for joining us. One of the things that comes through, both through from the Second World War, and not so much to now but still exists, is the bravado that exists within the armed services. Around the Second World War, if you came back and you considered to have any problems from it, it was probably a lack of moral fibre. You were considered not to be strong enough, which still exists a fair bit within the armed services, Malcolm.
Look, I think it does. I think it has diminished. So within the armed services hierarchy, for example, there is now a growing recognition that these are real problems that will happen to people involved in combat, do need appropriate attention and intervention, and that assistance is a valuable thing. Whereas after earlier conflicts, there was quite a suspicion about the role of mental health professionals. So things are changing. But there's still a way to go.
You know how you hear from... I saw a thing on the ABC where they took a look at post-traumatic stress, and especially with veterans from Afghanistan. And you would have the person from the hierarchy in the army saying, oh, yes, we're very well aware of it and we've set up these procedures. And no, it's not considered to be any type of... it won't affect your career if you talk to us and this sort of stuff. But then you hear the soldiers on the ground saying, yeah, we know that, but that isn't what it's like. It's still considered to be a weakness. You still worry that it's going to affect your career if this is what you want to be as a soldier. Do you tend to hear the right sort of talk coming from armed services in comparison to what happens on the ground?
Oh, look, I think there's still a way to go in thinking in an enlightened manner about these issues. I think there's still a way to go for that to permeate every bit of our defence forces. I think with due respect to the senior leadership, I don't think it's all lip service. I think there is a genuine intent to improve things, and there has been considerable investment in trying to promote awareness of mental health issues and to promote their treatment. But I accept that getting that to permeate right through to every unit to change a culture is not a simple thing.
Malcolm, do you notice a difference between the way servicemen are affected to servicewomen?
Well, I think it's only something we're beginning to learn about, of course, because still the number of servicewomen working close to combat zones is relatively small, although they have been present in roles such as nurses for some time. The basic symptom patterns we see of post-traumatic stress disorder when it occurs in women are fundamentally the same. I think one of the challenges, though, is, for example, in the Defence Force, where women still represent a minority, presenting for treatment in what might be otherwise an all-male climate can be quite challenging. So, for example, in the inpatient unit at Heidelberg Repat, we'd often have 15 men and 2 women. And for many women, receiving healthcare in that setting could be quite challenging, and they'd feel a bit the odd one out. So as the number of women increases in the ADF, thinking about how health services are going to meet their needs, recognise difficulties when they occur, is going to be really important.
Also, one of the challenges for many women who face themselves in a position that they're in a male-dominated workplace is that they're almost expected to be tougher than men.
Well, yes, or whether they perceive or that is a real need.
Yeah,
I think that's quite right. And as a consequence, for many women, admitting that they develop mental health problems can be more challenging than usual. Thankfully, that's counterbalanced by the fact that we know women generally are more sensible about opening up about mental health problems and more likely to seek help.
John, good morning, John.
Yeah, I'm just ringing. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I go to Heidelberg every Monday. I'm doing a rehabilitation program at the moment, and I've been in Ward 17 twice. But the family, you know, like my kids and, well, my wife left me, you know. There's no support, you know. Like, it's really hard.
John, as a vet, what are the things that you feel that you need for support?
Well, understanding, like, you know, like my wife just left me, you know, like we're still married. I mean, we've been married, what, 36 years now, and you think after all that time, you know, like, and the kids, you know, they just don't, you know.
John, do you reckon that it's not only work with the individual, but there needs to be work with families of veterans so that they understand what's happening?
Well, I think they do. I mean, my daughter-in-law reckons there's nothing wrong with me, you know. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you know, sort of, you know, it's very hard.
No doubting, John, and it's something that many of us won't understand because I guess as you hear so often, you have to be there to understand.
Yeah, but I mean, the way we were treated when we come home wasn't good either, you know, and that all plays on your mind as well, you know.
Like, it wasn't flash.
Yeah.
John, let me go back to Malcolm about that idea that it's not only the veterans that need support but the family, and for the veterans to be able to get the support they need. Perhaps it needs to cast a wider net, Malcolm, and look at the whole family.
Oh, look, I think undoubtedly that's true. So there's a growing trend in mental health care generally to involve families more than we did historically, and that should be true in this area as well. So increasingly mental health services looking after veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder would be looking to involve their partners, their children. If we look at, it's all of course dependent upon funding to provide that element of service.
Yep.
So the Vietnam Veterans Counselling Service is now funded to do that kind of work. We've known from research that if we look at the children of Vietnam veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, rates of mental health disorder in their children do appear to be increased compared to the general population. And whilst you could look at that in many different ways, no doubt living with most often a dad with problems like post-traumatic stress disorder can make childhood pretty tough.
Anthony, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, Anthony.
I'm waking up early to do some work before I go to work. I've counselled some Vietnam vets and some returning servicemen from the Gulf. And what I find sometimes is I've just listened to the professor's chat, and he's absolutely right. The kind of culture that's in the army sometimes makes it very, very hard for them to seek help, because they're supposed to be tough, and they're supposed to be in the new army, in the new world, where we were supposed to know about these things that affect us, like post-traumatic stress disorder. And the thing that I find is that it gets very difficult for them to even believe that they've been affected. And then when partners and children, because I'm a child and family psychologist, start noticing things about dad particularly, and mum sometimes, that it becomes such a barrier for them to not only seek help, but be able to be open to help.
And be aware that there's something going on, Anthony.
Exactly. And it's not like no one knows about post-traumatic stress, but it's sort of like they have this idea that if they show their true feelings, then they'll let down their mates or they'll let down their family, because there's this, in a sense, reverence of their job now, in that they're, you know, the way policing. And I think sometimes the rest of the general population that they come back to sort of expects them to be, tougher than our World War II veterans or World War I veterans. And there's this, you know, sort of almost...
So we need to give them a break.
Oh, I think so. And I think that we need to help them outside the armed services, because there's also a culture in there. While they're saying that there's all these... I don't to say that the Heidelberg group doesn't do great work, it just becomes very difficult for the army to say one thing and have the resources to be able to deal with the needs of it.
Resources are really interesting one, Anthony, and that while they're still servicemen, there may be more resources for them than when they're not servicemen anymore.
Exactly.
Malcolm?
Yeah, look, I think one way of thinking about this is the importance of intervening early in any mental health disorder, including post-traumatic stress disorder. and clearly the best opportunity, therefore, would be while someone's still in the Defence Force. So important in what the Defence Force has been trying to develop is greater capacity to detect these problems in the months after someone served in conflict and then to intervene in a timely fashion. But, as your caller has suggested, there is still some stigma alive. There is still the natural avoidance that is part of the disorder. And for some soldiers who have returned from combat, within months or a few years of returning, they're looking to leave the armed services and they're very preoccupied with other issues in their life, like trying to get back into work, like trying to restore a family, like trying to find a place to settle down. And so they can get on this treadmill of trying to deal with those issues, not dealing with them very effectively, and never actually seeking treatment for the root cause that may be making it all more difficult.
Bill joined us. Good morning, Bill.
Just me. My son, he's still in the Army. He's talking about getting out, but he's been to Afghanistan a number of times. He was wounded. He's come back, and you can pick it that he's not doing too well, but the Army doesn't seem to be really controlling it all that well either. They've pulled him off active duties, got him doing desk work and things like that, and he's just feeling as though he's a nobody at the moment.
You know, and I've heard that from other vets and from other people who have returned, that if you've come back from being active and then you're put into a desk and you're not recognised, it's almost like it's a very physical thing, I guess, and there's a need for them to still be doing stuff, Bill.
Yeah, not only that, with the Afghanistan thing, with the announcement that they're pulling the troops out, a lot of the boys don't feel like the job's done. While he's been over there, some of the fellas he's worked with that have stayed at home have got promotions, which he's missed out on, and he's just feeling as though he's been walked over.
Yeah, that's such a difficult thing for a person, especially someone that's served, Malcolm.
Yeah, look, and I empathise with Bill watching his son a great deal. I think something of what Bill's saying relates to the pride that many of our Defence Force members feel in their work, and really a very strong sense of wanting to be part of a team and not wanting to let that team down. So even when they then are struggling, that can create a lot of tension around, do I discuss this because I don't want to be seen to letting the team down? I don't want my career to be affected. They're very dedicated professional people. And the prospect that if I talk about this, it will affect my career, as one of the previous callers outlined, undoubtedly still remains a common fear.
Malcolm, one of the texts that has just come through says, trauma also comes from what you've done as much as what you've as has been done to you and what you see. Soldiers from current deployments face a far more complicated battlefield. Is that something that's a fair comment, Malcolm?
Yes, I think there is some truth in that comment. We know that moral complexity of a situation increases the risk of the development of post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, clearly all wars are morally complex situations. Please don't misinterpret my comment. But some situations are more complex than others. So where it's difficult to define and identify who your enemy is, where your apparent enemy may turn out to be someone you might not expect, like a woman or a child, where in many ways the enemy may be part of a crowd in which you're mingling and suddenly turn into your enemy unexpectedly, they're clearly very morally complex situations.
John, good morning.
Good morning. Look, I'm a veteran from the Malayan and Borneo conflicts in the 1960s, and I've lived with post-traumatic stress for nearly 50 years, and it wasn't until I retired some 5 or 6 years ago that I actually had sought help from a psychiatrist because of the nightmares and the flashbacks that came back. I suppose I learned to live with it, like my grandfather and my father were both veterans of the First and Second World Wars, and we were just brought up with the fact that you know, shut up and you go on with your life.
What did you find, though, John, was fulfilling about actually going to a counsellor and sorting it out?
Well, I went to a lady doctor. Well, it was actually through DVA, actually. A DVA person, you know.
Well, so that's good.
They found that I had it. And, it, you know, I really just wouldn't go and wouldn't talk about it. But let me tell you, since I've been, it's been absolutely wonderful. The nightmares have sort of diminished and, well, not so bad as what they were. I mean, not to be able to go out and stay in motels because the nightmares would cause you to urinate during the night and sort of, you know, it was very, very embarrassing. I couldn't stay at anybody's house.
But you've found that since you've done that, John, that the experience has been incredibly beneficial for you.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. I'm sort of living a lot better with it now, I really am. So
that's a great story.
Can I just say, too, that one of the other things that's a bit difficult to sort of live with is that, and I'm not whinging about it, but the Malayan and Borneo conflicts get no press whatever. It was a very silent war and, you know, we didn't want to upset the Indonesians and so you don't hear very much about it. But it was just as, you know, just as bloody bad as any of the other wars, from what I understand.
It's so true, John, and I'm sitting here nodding because that has been an issue that we've taken a look at on the program as well.
You know, it took the Koreans 50 years to get theirs. We've only just got a national day for veterans, the 31st of August, and it's taken all those years. So anyhow, we'll get on with it on Anzac Day and we'll be marching. That's the main thing.
Good on you, John. Thank you very much. We just heard the benefits that John's talking about from actually finally going to counselling. Is that something that is hopeful for you and uplifting for you, Malcolm, is the recognition that many servicemen and women who do go to counselling and seek assistance do find that there are very positive results?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very important call and not an uncommon story that when there's a major change in life, like retirement, is often a time when people are sort of forced to take stock a bit and to deal with things. And part of John's story that is really important to get across is that even after having a disorder for many years, treatment can be of assistance. It might be hard to get rid of things completely when they've been there for that long, and common sense would suggest that, wouldn't it? But that treatment can be of assistance is important. And clearly, as John was explaining his story, his life, and I dare say that of those around him, was better for it.
Lois, good morning.
Yeah, Trevor, you're to be congratulated on the subjects that you attempt. I just wanted to say, and I'll never be at war, the thing is that there's no money. This is what the government and everyone says. There's no money to treat these people, soldiers, ex-soldiers, when they come back. But there's plenty of money to send them to war and to keep them there.
And, Lois, don't they yak it up, the politicians, when they say, and we're so proud of our servicemen, we stand by them, they're important to us. They yak it up then, but then whether or not they're prepared to put in the resources to support them when they're out of the armed services and when they start to struggle and difficulty, and whether or not the Department of Veterans Affairs give them the money and don't make it difficult for them, that's where the real issues lie.
Oh, look, it's just appalling that they keep on saying there is no money. Plenty of money to send them over there, but no, it's. I'll be pleased when they're all home and we forget about war over there. Need to look after our own shores and our own home.
Lois, thank you. Malcolm, it's very easy to politicians to talk big about how much we support, how much we care about our servicemen, how they're heroes to us in community. Whether or not then we give them the services when they're out is another issue, and the resources that are available to them. And whether or not, I mean, it's a tough job at Departments of Veteran Affairs, I don't doubt that. But quite often, many veterans feel that they have to prove too much to be able to get the support that they need.
Yeah, look, it is a very thorny issue. I think the first part of that issue is really around the decision to go to war in the first place, isn't it? Which, you know, it must be one of the most burdensome decisions to ever have to make. I just hope when we do make a decision to go to war, we have to acknowledge all of the issues that will produce, and amongst them will be some people with mental health difficulties. It's going to happen, and I'm not always sure at the time that figures in the calculations. When people do return, I still think it's better that our politicians are saying we thank these people for what they've done for us and greeting them back than them not saying that. So one of your previous callers, a Vietnam veteran, described how, in fact, their return was quite hostile, including many politicians didn't want to talk about the war the moment it was over. And for many of them, that's an extremely bitter memory. So I'd rather the politicians saying, good on you and we welcome you back, than not. Yes, the Department of Veterans Affairs are charged with a difficult job, aren't they, deciding how much public money to extend to the care and welfare of veterans who've had entitled service. I think generally they try to do a pretty fair and reasonable job. Sometimes the process does get a bit too bureaucratic, there's no doubt about that. And part of that is exercising responsibility of spending public money. The best exercise does involve at least a sympathetic process and not an overly bureaucratic one.
Yeah, and look, I'm not saying that it's not important that politicians recognise and talk up what servicemen do and the important role that they have for us in Australia and around the world. That politicians should be talking them up, but there's a matter of making sure that you not only talk them up, but you provide the resources for them when they're no longer within the armed services.
Yeah, correct. Walk the walk as well as talk the talk.
Yeah. Gary, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, Gary.
I was just listening to what Lois had to say, and I was involved in the Melbourne Voyager cases, so I know Malcolm's reports and things. For the government to say that they don't know about PTSD is just rubbish. The Melbourne Voyager collision was the biggest non-military disaster in Australia's history. It happened on the 10th of February 1964. A lot of men drowned. A lot of men suffered from various things, but mainly PTSD, which is the callers have talked about, alcoholism, PTSD, the whole thing. Now, the government fought that the whole way. There was the captain of the ship said afterwards, said, go and get drunk. Then there were two royal commissions. Then they fought everything in the High Court. And finally, matters got slowly resolved. Then the poor blokes got caught up with some what I can only call rogue solicitors. One was struck off last week in the Court of Appeal. But when I've spoken to these guys, from 1964 till now, and they're dying now, and the government's ignored them. And it's not war, but they're in equivalent to war.
Mm.
And there are reports from Malcolm, from everybody else, and Malcolm will recall them. The government's known about PTSD. It may be called something else. It might be...
Shell shock.
It doesn't matter what you call it. This has been known for years, and the lowest made the comment, you've got all the money to send them, but when they come back, they're just ignored. Not totally ignored, but ignored. And there was a show on the ABC recently about, I think it was an artist who went in to Afghanistan, has come back and sort of blown the whistle on PTSD. Now, you need people who are the non-military people to come out and say, listen, I've lived with this guy or this woman, and they're having nightmares and sweats and God knows what else. Now, they won't all be PTSD. But the government's rubbish. And that's not just the current government, it's every government.
Gary, do you reckon there's an element of, okay, there's this, and as a lawyer, there's an element of, okay, there's this problem, but if we keep putting them off and we keep getting it tied up in legal systems, sooner or later they do die off?
Well, exactly. But these young blokes were 16, 17-year-olds, yes, sir, no, sir, and they're told, well, you haven't got a claim or whatever.
Hmm.
Oh, well, that's okay, I won't do anything.
But
unfortunately for them, they got caught up with some people who didn't help them, some lawyers who didn't help them. Now, some of these blokes, there have been settlements, they haven't got their money, and the lawyer's being sued for $7 or $8 million. So not only have you got PTSD, alcoholism, now they've settled cases, they can't get their money.
Malcolm, do you just want to comment?
Well, I think an important part of the call is an acknowledgement that post-traumatic stress disorder can happen other than in combat situations. That's absolutely right. So The military accidents do occur. The nature of the work that the military do is dangerous, even in training. And terrible accidents like the Melbourne Voyager collision will result in development of cases of post-traumatic stress disorder. There's no question about that. And that too does need to be recognised.
The issue, and we spoke briefly about this, about bureaucracies earlier, but it's a government agency is what we're working with. And there can be so much red tape, so much bureaucracy. And does there need to separate that bureaucracy from emotion and from things of the heart? Because that seems to be a problem that we hear all the time, Malcolm.
Yes, it's not uncommon. There's no question about it. Yes, in a way, I'd agree. Traditionally, the Department of Veterans Affairs compensation scheme has intermingled compensation for war-related disorders and entitlement to treatment. And I think progressively they're moving to disentangle those two things. And I think that's very important. So it becomes possible to receive treatment independent of the process around a compensation claim. And I'd support that strongly. Of course, if a compensation claim is protracted, that's going to make treatment that little bit more difficult, isn't it? But at least treatment can begin, whereas historically some level of disability had to be established first, and entitlement established first, which could often hold up treatment for a very long time.
Can I just ask you, we'll finish this conversation in a minute, but how important is a sense of purpose for people who are suffering from post-traumatic stress? We know a friend of ours, James, did a lot of work, and he did a voyage across to Tasmania by boat and had a sense of purpose and things to do, especially of a physical nature. How important is that for returned vets?
Well, no more or less important than it is for all of us at the end of the day, isn't it? At a basic level in sort of human psychology, a sense of purpose and meaning in life is important. And what you're describing, in a way, is that many people with disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder find it extremely difficult to find that purpose again and to retain a purpose. So we do see people who develop disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder. One of the ways they regain that purpose is by assisting others, you know, through things like ex-service organisations or informal peer support networks. For others, it's through doing different kinds of volunteer work or physical activity. It's incredibly important. Life without purpose is a very difficult exercise for anybody, isn't it?
We'll take one more call from Jeff. Hello, Jeff.
Yeah, hello, guys. Yeah, I was just wondering, actually, I saw you sort of almost touched on it there. What I was just wondering about is, actually, is have you actually had a look or been able to find out from the servicemen or women that actually have not suffered post-traumatic disorder, if you've been able to ascertain exactly if there's anything about those people or any way that they've actually been able to deal with it personally themselves or whatever to avoid it, or also if there's any way that you can actually identify which people are actually more likely to suffer from it against others who perhaps wouldn't. Is there anything that you know of in that regard?
Jeff, we spoke a little bit about the susceptibility earlier in the program. I guess, Malcolm, with returned soldiers, that they have a sense of purpose or that they have a way of moving back into society easily, is that looked at?
Yes, I think there are attempts to look at it. I mean, it is a great question because we often focus on studying those who've got difficulties and might miss what can we learn from those who don't have difficulties. And it's important to acknowledge that is, at the end of the day, more people than not. We do know that people who return to effective support networks, have good relationships, have the capacity to find purpose in life, and perhaps have resilience and strength, and the capacity to talk verbally about difficulties, all of those increase your risk of coping better. So we need to do whatever we can to foster them. In that sense, it's a great concern that for many people who particularly leave the Defence Force relatively soon after combat, re-establishing themselves in a new civilian life can be very, very difficult. And we need to continue to work on finding ways to assist people to regain that purpose.
Because they're coming from an environment that's incredibly structured into one that isn't as well.
Yeah, correct. The adjustment after being in the military to, if you like, civilian life has been a notorious problem really for centuries, and we still struggle with it. So part of the responsibility, I think, that comes with sending people to conflict is helping them occupationally on their return. In this day and age of highly structured employment, it's much more challenging perhaps than it used to be, but we need to do it.
Malcolm, a pleasure talking to you this morning, and thank you for giving so much of your time.
No problem at all, Trevor. A pleasure.